Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The civil war in Syria has reached a stalemate and has turned into a proxy war for regional and international actors. Just this week, the European Union agreed to drop its ban on arming the opposition forces, and Syria says it's receiving advanced arms that have the capacity to engage ballistic missiles. The UN estimates that 80,000 people have been killed and more than 1.5 million have been displaced. Joining us to discuss media coverage is Jonathan Steele, roving foreign correspondent with The Guardian. Jonathan has reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel, and Palestine. His latest book is Ghosts of Afghanistan, The Haunted Battleground. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
Well, good for you to have me.
Nice to have you. And we're also joined by Bob Dreyfus, who has been extensively blogging about Syria. A couple of his latest pieces, Neocons, Hill Democrats Push for War Against Syria, and Assad Makes Crucial Gains as U.S.-Russia Peace Conference Teeters. Bob Dreyfus is contributing editor at The Nation, a contributing writer at Mother Jones, and senior correspondent for The American Prospect. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. And President Obama's counterterrorism speech received wall-to-wall media coverage last week. We decided to wait a week to talk about this, just to find out how the media cover this. Now, in the speech, he outlined his policies on drone attacks and the fate of detainees at Guantanamo. And the overall reaction in the media was that the president essentially redefined the so-called war on terror. A New York Times headline was, "Pivoting from a war footing, Obama acts to curtail drones, yet the drone strikes continue." So what is actually changing on the ground? We're joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, where he covers legal and national security issues. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Bob, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I thought the most enlightening piece of the week, at least for me, was a piece from Jane Perlis at the New York Times. She did a piece kind of foreshadowing the meeting between the two Chinese and American presidents going to happen next weekend in California, of all places. And she talked about how the Chinese are starting to think seriously about how a rising power meets an already established power and what that's going to mean for relations between the two countries. And by the way, in the piece, it also mentioned that the Chinese had given a big gift, quote unquote, to the United States by telling the noisy North Korean portly youngster to shut up and behave, and that they were going to henceforth support the idea of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which is something of a change in Chinese policy. So I thought that was a really interesting piece about big stuff that really matters.
And so what did she come up with? I mean, did she quote people who, you know, gave her their assessment of where they think this is going in the future?
Well, she was covering in part Tom Donilon's trip there. That's the national security advisor. But she spoke to several, you know, influential Chinese think tank and advisor people. So, you know, kind of got a little bit of, I mean, you can't just sit down with Chinese leaders and get them to tell you what they really think, but she did get, I think, some Chinese insiders to talk about what they would like to see happen in the meeting between Obama and Xi next weekend.
Yeah, we'll have to do a show on this because it's interesting to read the articles about how the environment is changing in China, for example. There was one in the New York Times recently about how the air quality is so bad that people with money are actually leaving because they don't want their kids to go outside.
Yeah, well, I mean, air quality is bad, but let's not overlook the fact that in the last couple of decades, China has brought about 500 million people out of poverty. If you look at the UN, you know, millennium goals that they set, whatever that was, 10 or 12 years ago or something, nearly all of the people who've left poverty in the entire world live in China. And so they've really accomplished quite a bit of good there, despite trashing the environment in some ways. And by the way, and that they're making some real important progress, too. I mean, most of the world's technological progress in alternate energies like solar power in particular and wind and so on is coming from China.
Well, we'll have to do a show on this. So thank you for that. That's Bob Dreyfus, contributing editor at The Nation. And what about you, Scott? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'd probably give my nod to a piece that Dan Kliveman did for Newsweek that was out on the 29th, based on an interview he conducted with Eric Holder, in which Holder is expressing remorse for the Justice Department behaving so aggressively with reporters in these leak investigations, suggesting maybe he didn't make the right call on these decisions. And, you know, it seems that that article, and maybe the piece is itself a bit of news, because it shows the way Holder is trying to build better ties with media organizations and with the liberal base of the Democratic Party. But I think in the end of the day, he comes out looking like an ineffectual leader at the Justice Department who doesn't really seem to have his firm hands in control and seems to be deferring to lower-level prosecutors on important policy decisions like these. And I think, you know, coming out of that interview, we also saw Holder's initiative to have an off-the-record meeting with major media today. And, of course, that was so off the record that it was immediately reported almost everywhere. Holder noted that the president had given him until the second week of July to come up with meaningful limitations on the way prosecutors handled these leak investigations. So I think we're clearly seeing some pulling back there.
And just for a little bit of background, so the DOJ seized phone records linked to about 100 Associated Press reporters and the private emails of a Fox News reporter, right?
Rosen, that's correct. And I think both of these actions were unprecedented. In fact, not that they hadn't, that requests hadn't been made for this sort of action by prosecutors in the past, but the requests had been routinely rejected by higher-ups in the Justice Department, even during the Bush administration. So this shows an unleashing of prosecutorial fury.
And do we know what they were looking for exactly? Why did they target these 100 AP reporters, for example?
They wanted to know who their sources were. It's that simple. Identify the sources, and I'd say the fact of their investigation and of their seeking this information obviously has a chilling effect. So it makes it almost impossible for the AP, which had, I mean, we had two reporters at the AP who really had been the lead sources of information about certain CIA operations in the war on terror. You have them effectively shut down by this. So I think the purpose was less to discover who committed a crime than to shut down the AP as a reporting source on these matters. That's the effect of it.
And Bob, just quickly, what are your thoughts on this? How chilling is this?
Oh, I would say semi-chilling. It's probably more chilling to sources than to reporters. You have to understand, by the way, they weren't wiretapping these reporters or listening to their conversations or anything like that. They were just getting the, you know, list of phone numbers that they used. And it's a terrible thing that they did, but I can't get too outraged by it, because I think this kind of stuff, you know, just happens all the time. It may not on such a big, wide scale. Certainly Obama has done a lot more leak investigations, but every president going back to the plumbers has wanted to, you know, crack down on leaks, and Obama seems to have decided to actually do something about it. I can't believe that too many people are really chilled by it, but there is a lot of anger, and maybe that'll get some changes made, both in the way the law works and in the way the Justice Department behaves in the future.
Do you think that this will affect sources coming forward?
No. A little bit, but not really. I mean, people know in these days, unless you're going to, you know, wear a Groucho Marx face and go skulking around at midnight in a parking garage, that your electronic record is available for any and all to see, including, no doubt, you know, a couple of hundred Chinese hackers in Shanghai. So, I mean, no, I can't believe anybody is going to be chilled by this, really, truly.
That's a nice visual. All right. And Jonathan Steele, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I saw a very good piece by one of our writers on The Guardian called Aditya Chakraborty about the riots in Sweden. So I just don't know whether they were actually ever reported in the United States, but it's been quite a reasonably big story in Europe, and particularly in Britain, because we had terrible riots here 2 years ago, and now Sweden has had 5 days of rioting last week, which was quite similar, beginning because of a case where police shot somebody dead in peculiar circumstances, then people, you know, gathered and to protest, and then it turned into a riot, and eventually cars were burnt, and there was a great deal of violence. And so people have now looked again at the whole Swedish model and in discovering that Sweden isn't such a wonderful welfare state, a country of equality and moderation and decency, as we have been led to believe.
Hmm. Well, how is this being reported in the European press? Obviously, we're hearing coverage in the BBC. The New York Times has been reporting it. A couple others.
It has across the Atlantic.
Yeah.
It is an important story. Well, it's been covered mainly in terms of you know, what it tells us about Sweden and the fact that the Swedish model is coming under scrutiny. I mean, I think when people have now started to look at the facts in Sweden, I mean, to be quite honest, not many foreign correspondents go to Sweden ever unless there's some big story. So, in a sense, it's been under the radar for a number of years. But we've, as a result of this and putting it now under the microscope, people have realized that actually the Swedish welfare state has been crumbling for about 5 or 10 years, and Sweden, like so many other countries, has come under the sort of neoliberal Washington consensus, you know, trying to privatize their public services as much as possible, lowering corporate taxes, lowering income taxes, and as a result, getting much greater inequality. In fact, it's now been shown that Sweden has, in the last few years, had the biggest growth inequality of all the 31 industrialized countries that are part of the OECD. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's no longer true that Sweden is a kind of model for other countries. I think it's just joined the queue to move to this kind of neoliberal economics.
Well, we're definitely going to cover this next Friday. We've already found a reporter to bring on. So I'm glad you brought that up, Jonathan. And we will put links to all of these articles right after the show. And that is Jonathan Steele, a foreign correspondent with The Guardian, Bob Dreyfus, contributing editor at The Nation, and Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. And if you'd like to join us, we're going to talk today about media coverage of what is happening on the ground in Syria. We're also going to talk about President Obama's recent counterterrorism speech. So if you have any thoughts on how these issues have been covered in the media, we'd love to hear from you. And then if you saw a story this week or heard a story that you think deserves more coverage, give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Jonathan, let's talk a little bit about Syria and what do you make of the recent international activities that have been happening. Just this week, the EU agreed to drop its ban on arming the opposition forces. Syria says it's receiving advanced arms that have the capacity to engage ballistic missiles. Russia, U.S., and U.N. officials are going to meet next week in Geneva. Assad said he's planning to go. There's just so much happening on a regular basis. Things are moving quickly. What is your overall assessment of the latest?
Well, I think the EU arms embargo decision, which was led by Britain and France, is really a disaster because it's going to encourage the rebels, who seem very leery about coming to the Geneva conference at all, to make them think that if the Geneva conference fails, they'll get more arms. So they're certainly not in a mood to negotiate seriously. And there's been a sort of smokescreen, I think, by the British, particularly, and the French, in using this extraordinary argument that the purpose of lifting the arms embargo is to try and press Assad to come to the negotiating table. I think it's a smokescreen for two reasons. First of all, the Assad people have said that they're going to come to the negotiating table already. They didn't need any pressure to go there. As I just mentioned, it's the opposition, that it's the rebels that are most leery about coming and on whom pressure should be put to begin to think of negotiation. And secondly, it's meant to disguise the fact that that the West, and this now includes the United States, has made a massive U-turn, because the position that's been held for about 2 years has been to say there can be no negotiations with the Assad regime. He has to resign first and depart, like Mubarak did in Egypt and Ben Ali did in Tunisia, before there can be any negotiations. Well, now they've agreed, basically, that the regime will negotiate while Assad is still in post. And so they're trying to conceal and divert attention from this huge U-turn, which, I mean, I think it's a good, I'm glad they're doing it, but they are trying to hide the fact that they've made a big policy correction by pretending Assad is the one who has to be pressed to come to the negotiating table.
And this policy isn't going into effect until September, right?
No, it could go into effect in August already, but they say that they're going to hold back for the moment to see what happens at Geneva.
Bob, you've been writing about this extensively. What's your take on this?
Well, I agree with Jonathan. I mean, this is a real mess of Obama's own making. It was 2 years ago that he, I guess, thought because the other Arab Spring movements had toppled people so quickly that, oh, well, Assad is a goner, so I'm just going to jump in, you know, right away as soon as the first shots were fired and say Assad has to resign. And that has been a huge blunder by the United States. Not only did it put America's prestige on the line over that comment, but it encouraged the rebellion to grow from a small scale to a countrywide, you know, violent one very quickly. And I think Obama is just now beginning to realize, oh my gosh, we can actually talk to Moscow and we can talk to Beijing about problems like North Korea and Syria and Iran, and maybe they'll cooperate and help us. So for the first time, Kerry seems to be putting a lot of energy into dealing with Moscow, trying, I think, on a sincere basis to try to work out some sort of agreement. And really and truly, the pressure that has to be brought now by the United States is on our erstwhile allies, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who are the main backers and without whom the rebels would fall flat on their collective faces, along with Turkey. If we can put pressure on these guys to restrict the flow of arms to the rebellion, then perhaps these rebels will either coalesce and decide to attend the conference or fragment and fall apart. I was watching the State Department briefing yesterday. It was kind of a clown show because the questioners, the reporters, were all saying to Jen Psaki, who's the new spokesperson there, what about these rebels? Are they going to go to the conference? Do you want them to go to the conference? They say they're not going. And she kept saying, we support them, but we do want them to come. She was like all confused and mixed up. And so this is a huge problem, because if Washington and Moscow agree on a conference and Assad agrees to send people to it and the rebels say no, then where does the United States go? I mean, it looks ridiculous in the eyes of the world. So I think this is a huge problem now for the United States.
And Scott Horton, as these international players get ready to jump in here, I mean, NPR has been doing some reporting about just horrific bloodshed. I mean, people are being shot on a regular basis. I mean, what does this mean for, you know, the people who live in Syria and their democratic aspirations?
Well, I'd say proxy war is almost the worst possible scenario. And we're seeing a situation now where war crimes were documented and occurred infrequently. Today, they're an everyday part of the conflict. So the people who are bearing the brunt of this are the civilian population.
And Jonathan, what are your thoughts on that? Because, I mean, and on the radio, for example, there have been stories about how people are really suffering on the ground. But a lot of the media coverage tends to focus on the politics, which is also very important. But, you know, how is that playing out in Europe? Are many stories getting out about just how this is affecting the people on the ground?
Well, a lot of it is connected with places where there's direct fighting. I mean, you carried that report just now in the news bulletin before this about Al-Qusayr, this city that's been under siege for some weeks now. And we're getting the usual thing of only hearing what's happening on the rebel side and, you know, the victims caused by the Syrian government's attacks and so on. And that's been the repetitive pattern. We hear very little about the killing that goes on by the rebels, except when occasional videos come out. because obviously reporters, it's much harder for them to travel into Damascus to get visas and then to travel to the front line. It's virtually excluded. And so the sort of on-the-ground reporting is heavily one-sided. But you're right, there's also coverage of the humanitarian problems in the refugee camps, particularly in Jordan. Everybody seems to cover the Jordanian camps particularly rather than the ones in Turkey. But even in the Jordanian ones, we're now finding there were some stories, terrible stories last week from the BBC about people in those camps, girls in those camps being forced into prostitution or marriage with rich Gulfi Arabs and who they've virtually become house slaves and prostitutes in domestic circumstances. So it's very grim.
And what challenges do journalists face in trying to get these stories out?
Well, there's no problem in getting into the refugee camps that are across the border in Jordan or Turkey or Lebanon. As I say, it's difficult to get into Syria because visas are not very often given. I mean, I got a visa in February this year. It was the first one I'd had for 6 months. I think the regime makes a big mistake in not allowing more journalists in, because I think there would be more balanced coverage if they did, and people would begin to talk to, you don't talk to supporters of the regime when you go to Damascus only. Of course, you want to talk to the officials as much as possible, but you also talk to people who are living in the problems of Damascus. And then there's the whole sort of issue of the silent majority. I mean, huge numbers of people who don't support the government, but they don't support the rebels either, and they're just worried about the civil war and they want it to end. And many of them are worried about the Islamists taking over, that if there is a new regime in Syria, it could be dominated by Islamists. And really most people, particularly in Damascus, are very secular. It's a very modern, secular country, and people may be nominally Sunni, but they don't often go to the mosque. And they're worried about these Islamists taking over and the Muslim Brotherhood and so on.
And Jonathan, we have just about a minute left with you. What do you think will ultimately happen with Assad?
Well, I think he's staying on for the time being, and I think the U.S. is now beginning to accept that, at least John Kerry is, and I think it's an important change of policy. We haven't quite seen all the ramifications of that change of policy we're coming in, but I think they're really desperate to try and find a negotiated solution, and I think they're beginning to see that Assad is not going to be toppled in a military way.
And it seems like also the proxy war seems to be helping these dictators.
Well, for them, for Saudi Arabia and Qatar, it's good to sort of have chaos. If that shows that sort of the Arab Spring brings chaos, a very simple message they're trying to get across. So, don't try and rock the boat.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for staying up late with us, and thanks for joining us again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you. That is Jonathan Steele, roving foreign correspondent with The Guardian. He's reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel, and Palestine. After the break, we'll speak a little bit more about Syria, and I'd love to hear what Bob and Scott think about what's going to happen with Bashar Assad and also how this proxy war is affecting other countries. And then we're going to talk about President Obama's counterterrorism speech. It got so much media attention, we decided to wait for about a week just to find out how people were responding. The overall response was that he essentially redefined the so-called war on terror, but the drone strikes continue. So how will this change, if anything will change, on the ground? And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about media coverage of that speech? And if you heard or saw a report this week that you think deserves more attention, give us a call and we'd love to hear about it. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org, and they're also included in the Your Call weekly email newsletter, which is easy to get and easy to sign up for, and it's free. Just click email newsletter at yourcallradio.org. Find the link that says email newsletter and click there. And then you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255 and joining in our weekly media roundtable, 866-798-TALK, or send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks to KALW listeners Mark Hotzenpiller of San Francisco, Joseph Rolfe of Palo Alto, Gina Borg of Oakland, and Catherine Brewer of San Francisco for supporting local public radio in our membership campaign that wrapped up just last week.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about local biodiversity. We recently did a show about the disappearing honeybees, which are needed to pollinate crops. We have them to thank for our fruits and vegetables. So what can we do in backyards and neighborhoods to make sure they thrive, to make sure other pollinators thrive? We'll also talk about what we can learn from places like Boston, where pollinators are returning. And then on Tuesday, we'll talk about, Tuesday, we'll talk about how immigration reform, some say it's reform, some say it's not really reform, but it's out there regardless of what you think. How is this going to affect the state of California? So be sure to tune in for that. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. We are joined by Bob Dreyfus, contributing editor at The Nation, contributing writer at Mother Jones, and senior correspondent for The American Prospect. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, where he covers legal and national security issues. We're going to spend a couple more minutes on Syria, and then we'll talk about President Obama's terrorism speech last week. We'd love to hear from you. What did you think about media coverage? It was covered extensively. You know, Medea Benjamin, when she spoke out at the speech and President Obama referred to her as a young lady who should be heard. I mean, that got a lot of attention. But what we found was lacking was an analysis of the overall speech. So what were your thoughts on that speech? And if you saw anything else this week that you'd like to talk about, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Bob, just to spend a few more minutes on Syria, I mean, what's so sad about this is that I mean, there's so much suffering going on. And, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on whether you think, and this is probably obvious, that, you know, people like President Obama and others look to other countries in the Middle East where the dictator has been brought down. And then they look at what's put in place and they don't like it. And so they say, well, Assad is bad, but who knows what the alternative might be?
Well, you know, look, the United States has been dealing with Assad family since the late 1960s, when Bashar al-Assad's father seized power there. So it's not like the Assads are an unknown quantity. And in fact, before the rebellion started, you know, we got along quite well with Assad, and so did Israel, which actually was conducting a sort of a back-and-forth round of peace negotiations, I would say maybe 10 years ago and even more recently, to try to find some sort of deal over the occupied Golan Heights. I mean, Assad, you know, is a bad guy. I guess one of my criticisms, though, of the media is the way they describe, they never say the Syrian government, it's always the regime. They talk about the murderous dictator. I mean, if I hear Wolf Blitzer say those kind of things one more time, I'm going to, you know, fall off my sofa. I mean, this is a very complicated issue. And I guess I want to give a shout out to Obama about something. Last year in the fall, his entire national security leadership, Hillary Clinton, David Petraeus, who was then at the CIA, Leon Panetta, who was at the Defense Department, and Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, four of them all recommended to Obama, please, let's get involved, let's start arming the rebels, let's, you know, take this on. And Obama, who was backed, by the way, by Joe Biden and Tom Donilon, the National Security Advisor, Obama overruled them. And I can't remember the last time a president overruled his entire national security staff on something so important. And he still shows, I think, a great, great reluctance to get deeply involved in Syria. I mean, I know the CIA is involved with some things, and the, you know, but we're not yet a full party to this war, and I think that's really something I would credit Obama for in staying out of this a little bit so far.
Well, and so what has changed since the piece you wrote about a week or so ago, Neocons Hill Democrats Push for War Against Syria?
Nothing. They're gotten louder and worse. The neocons are going bananas over the idea of the Geneva Conference. They say we're caving in to Putin, we're giving away the store, and the Democrats on the Hill, most of whom are in bed with AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the Israel lobby, and other, you know, interests as well, are also jumping up and down trying to get Obama to go in and sell arms to the or give arms to the rebels and so on. And Obama's not going along.
Well, and Scott, John McCain was just recently there taking photographs with some of the rebels.
That's exactly right. Producing what may have been the most remarkable tweet of the week, which was Lindsey Graham putting a claim on his office if he didn't come back alive. But I think in a more serious vein, really since the end of World War One, the big question about Syria has been preservation of this remarkable crazy quilt of communities, being sure that their integrity and their fundamental rights are preserved. And I think that's the major problem for Washington and for Europe right now. I mean, it's not taking down Assad. It's not suppressing Hezbollah. It's protecting all these various communities and being sure that they're able to survive continuing to function as an ongoing Syrian society. And for all of his flaws, the one plus for Assad has been that he did protect this crazy quilt of small communities and allowed them some measure of life. And I think that's really threatened and imperiled. And any solution going forward has got to focus on the civilians and the protections of their rights. And I see remarkably little of that, certainly none of it coming from John McCain, who's absolutely convinced that we can pick through these opposition groups and find one or two that are worth our support. Worth funding and worth giving arms to. I'm very skeptical of that.
Well, yeah, and speaking of citizens, I mean, we forget that this revolution in Syria started peacefully and was met with complete brutality and killings.
That's exactly right. And I think a proper role for the outside would be to focus blame and force accountability for those who abuse civilians and mistreat civilians. And that fades away when we get a proxy war and the West and the Russians and others, square off and take sides.
That is Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. We're also joined by Bob Dreyfus, contributing editor at The Nation. And let's hear from a few listeners on this. Let's go to Joshua in San Francisco. Hi, Joshua. Thanks for holding.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Wondering if you guys could... find the rebels for me. I just heard a report on your station that the UN had some sort of embargoes or sanctions against a fishing group that had Al-Qaeda. And speaking to President Obama redefining the war in Syria.
Joshua, it's hard to hear you. Did you say to define the rebels in Syria?
Yes, we just spoke about a few different opposition groups. We just referred to the opposition as the rebels. Are there multiple groups? Do they all have different names? Or is the UN enacting sanctions against one group as opposed to another? Are one rebel group and not another? Is one tied to Al-Qaeda, or are they all tied to Al-Qaeda?
Okay. Thank you. Sorry about that. Your line's kind of bad there. Bob, do you want to take that question? And then how do you actually answer that question from here? Where are you getting your information about these issues?
Well, certainly not by traveling to Syria. I guess... there are braver reporters than I, but I have no interest in going to Syria because I don't. I want to stay around and collect my Social Security. So I have nothing but admiration and praise for the reporters who go there. But I get my information by, reading the press like a lot of other people. Now, by the way, where the press in turn gets its information from is somewhat confusing. There are a number of outside groups. Many of whom are, fragmenting. There are probably a dozen of them, as well as groups that are, human rights type Syrian human rights groups that are monitoring the situation. They all have their own fish to fry in this thing, and it's a big question how many of them have actual ties to fighters and people on the ground. There are. All sorts of many stripes of Islamists in this. The most curious event in the recent couple of months, I think it was in April, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq announced that it was in fact one and the same organization as the al-Nusra group in Syria, which we've now put on the terrorism list. And so it's literally an Al-Qaeda spinoff that is, by all accounts, the most lethal and aggressive fighters in the Syrian rebellion. That doesn't mean all of them are, but it's a very confusing situation, and that's why they can't agree among themselves about who to send to the Geneva meeting if and when it happens. I'm becoming a little skeptical about whether it will. And many of the groups that make up the Syrian opposition are related to the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, which is a Sunni organization. And I guess I would conclude this by saying there's a horrible possibility that a Sunni-Shiite conflict could start to develop in the region, in which the Saudis and the Qataris support Sunnis in places like Syria and Iraq against Iran and the Maliki government in Iraq, as well as Hezbollah, and that it becomes a sectarian region-wide conflict. I think the scary prospect of that is one of the things that finally led Obama to get Kerry on the move diplomatically to try to, you know, calm things down a little bit.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Joshua. Let's go next to Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I really want to talk about Obama's speech, but for Syria, I think the U.S. have to be extremely cautious and careful, because what is happening right now, we have this horrible element, the neoconservative or the neocons, as one of your guests have said. They are still in control of the U.S. foreign policy. And really, it is about time to call those people, check them out, like McCain and the rest of them, to tell them, hey, you have done us enough damage in Iraq, Afghanistan, the rest. And they are the same people who have created this whole bogus war on terror. There is no such a thing as war on terror. The whole thing which scares the American people out of their wits, so they steal their saving account, homes, social security, and so on. The last thing I like to say is that Obama's speech was very shallow, did not say anything new. In fact, in many ways, and we don't have time to go through it, he have made it worse. This whole drone, it is a stupid thing. The terrorist thing is a police manner. It is not at all to be dealt with army. It is the new conservative policy of PNAC, Project for New American Century, and the whole destruction of the Middle East. And unfortunately, they're getting their way because of civil government like Bashar Assad, and because of Mr. Stephen Morsi in Egypt, and Saudi Arabia is as enemy to the Arab world as any other enemy in the Middle East.
Well,
sad.
It's very sad. Thank you, Eid. And before we talk about the speech, I just was wondering from you, Scott, do you think that Assad will remain in power?
I think he and those around him will be a force there for some period of time. And I think, the real focus of any peace effort necessarily is going to be shuffling him off the political stage and putting in his place a new group that can command allegiance both from some of Assad's followers and from opposition groups. That would be the formula. That's, I'm sure, the formula that Kerry is trying to discuss with Moscow right now. Not clear to me that that can be done.
All right. Well, thank you, Eid. We have another call on Obama's speech. Let's hear from Ward in San Francisco. Hi, Ward.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I was very disappointed, not surprised at all, by President Obama's reiteration of the use of terror and targeted and signature killings as a replacement for foreign policy or reasoned measures, much less, say, consider the rule of law, which seems to have been totally abandoned by the Obama administration. As people better than I have pointed out, we have a tradition in this Western civilization going back 800 years of bringing people to account and openly discussing and charging them rather than simply secretly assassinating them. And that seems to be President Obama's choice of weapons, is to have these hundreds of nighttime raids continuing across the globe with no accountability, and wanting a Congress whose only job is to fund the Defense Department, bring the State Department under the control of the State Department, and give people like Stanley McChrystal and General McRaven carte blanche to kill Americans without even telling us citizens what charges, what these people were accused of. I think the lack of focus on the first drone hearing is very telling. I think that the lack of coverage on Bradley Manning or WikiLeaks or the Tuesday JSOC meetings on developing the kill lists is something that the media really has just fallen down on the job, and is really this is the result of a consolidation of the ownership of media by private parties.
You brought up several points, and thank you for making them. Just to give this a little bit of context, Scott, what are your thoughts on this speech? And I also want to talk about a hearing that took place a couple of weeks ago that really didn't get much attention at all. But first on this speech, it got wall-to-wall coverage, and the overall response was that this is a game changer. The New York Times headline, pivoting from a war footing, Obama acts to curtail drones. What are your thoughts?
I think it is a game changer, but I think the change is going to be very slow. It's not going to be dramatic and sudden change. But I think certain aspects of the speech were absolutely remarkable. I mean, for instance, he said, I know the politics are hard, but history will cast a harsh judgment on this aspect of our fight against terrorism and those of us who failed to end it. That's a very rare remark for a political figure to make. He's essentially saying, we did wrong, we made terrible mistakes, and he's including himself in that number. He said, I failed to end this. And that's not going to be judged positively when people make a detached assessment of what happened. Absolutely extraordinary. But the speech is quite weak in terms of specifics about how he's going to change policy. I think he's indicated a change in drone policy. He's indicated a new effort to shut down Guantanamo and several other areas too, but he is committed to making changes and small incremental steps, and I think the change on the drone policy, for instance, is going to be by gradually devolving control over this to the military and taking it away from Pakistan, and I think we see in the drone strike that occurred earlier this week in Pakistan what looks more like continuity than change. That's causing a lot of people to think, well, where is this change in criteria that the president talked about? But nevertheless, I think I see the policy change and the works for it, and I even see acknowledgement of mistakes, although he's not going to say that in so many words.
Elias Grohl in Foreign Policy said, quote, Obama, it seems, is trying to have it both ways, keeping his effective drone strikes while getting his liberal critics off his back. The president has now thrown several bones to the left. He has once more pledged to close Guantanamo, reintroduce a media shield law for journalists, and consider some kind of oversight mechanism for drone strikes. But at the same time, he has retained expansive legal authority to carry out drone strikes at his will. What are your thoughts, Bob?
Well, of course he's maintained that authority, but I don't know what the writer of that piece was expecting from a president who is not a radical leftist. I mean, Obama was, I believe, too easily convinced at the beginning of his administration that drones would be an alternative to the Bush policy, namely unilateral interventions, the use of military force in counterinsurgency efforts, and so forth. And in fact, for 4 years, he has been reining in drone strikes. If you look at the numbers, they've been reduced about 50% every year since 2010. So there have only been, I believe, in Pakistan, something like 13 strikes this year, whereas 4 years ago there were something like over 100 and some. And so John Brennan, who I've interviewed in the past, who was Obama's counterterrorism advisor, is now the head of the CIA. He's been kind of a behind-the-scenes force in trying to rein in drone strikes, even as he and Obama oversaw them, of course. And now he wants to get the CIA back in the business of its traditional mission, intelligence, and shift the CIA away from drone strikes. It indeed is going to the military, although to a very secret part of the military, the Special Operations Command, which is not exactly going to be having, you know, discussions of this on The View or on Oprah or anything. So this is you know, a problematic thing which is going to go on, but which is being, I think, brought under control. I think his speech was very courageous and transformational, and it drew the appropriate howls of outrage from the hawks and the neoconservatives and others who consider Obama to be declaring defeat in the war against al-Qaeda and all this other nonsense. The fact is he's saying, you know, this war is now over. And that's a big, big shift, both rhetorical and in practice. When the Afghanistan withdrawal is complete in 2014, the CIA's strikes in Pakistan will stop. And, you know, it'll be Afghanistan's problem and not ours. These various anti-American and anti-Afghan rebel groups in Pakistan that are striking across the border.
And Scott, what are your thoughts on that? There was a hearing that took place on May 16th, and Lindsey Graham was questioning Michael Sheehan, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations. Democracy Now! Covered this. I was kind of shocked that I didn't really hear it anywhere else. So just quickly, Lindsey Graham says, "Do you agree with me that when it comes to international terrorism, we're talking about a worldwide struggle?" Michael Sheehan, "Absolutely." Lindsey Graham, "Would you agree with me that the battlefield is wherever the enemy chooses to make it?" Michael Sheehan, "Yes, from Boston to the FATA. Lindsey Graham, "And it could be any place on the planet. We have to be aware and act. And do you have the ability to act? Are you aware of these threats?" Michael Sheehan, "Yes, we have the ability to react. We're tracking these threats globally." And then Senator Angus King, an independent from Maine, responded at this hearing saying, "I've been here only 5 months. This is the most astounding and most astoundingly disturbing hearing that I've been to since I've been in D.C. You guys have essentially rewritten the Constitution here. You keep using the term associated forces. You said at one point it suits us very well. I assume it does suit you very well because you're reading it to cover everything and anything." Did you know about this hearing, Scott?
I did, and I tracked it, and I have to say I was somewhat flabbergasted by it. I mean, I know Michael Sheehan. I've known him for many, many years. And, of course, he has a background both with the Department of Defense and working with domestic police forces and counterterrorism. He was involved with New York City, for instance, amongst others. So the questions that were put to him and the answers that he gave are exactly the sort of answers I would expect of him, but they don't seem to me to coincide with the administration's current policy, particularly not as it was laid out at NDU or in things like the speech that Jay Johnson gave at Oxford recently, in which the administration has very clearly pulled back on important policy points. So I'll just say I think Michael Sheehan was off the reservation.
And why didn't this get more attention? I mean, this is kind of, I mean, shocking to hear that basically this is a perpetual war, a worldwide war.
I think you're hearing answers that were ideologically very much in tune with those of the Bush administration and very neoconservative in accent, and that this is just not the posture the administration has taken. In fact, I think it's very, very carefully distanced itself from those views.
So do you think that this speech was in reaction to this?
I think the speech, the NDU speech, and a number of others have been made quite consciously to pull back from that legacy and to criticize that legacy. I think the NDU speech was a pretty sharp criticism on basic policy grounds
of neoconservative thoughts and practices, and definitely cannot be reconciled with what Michael Sheehan said in that Senate committee hearing.
And Bob, did you hear about this hearing?
Yeah, and I agree with what you just said. I mean, I don't want to get too conspiratorial about things. I'm very opposed to conspiracy theories, but this recent drone strike a couple of days ago in Pakistan, coming just right after Obama's speech saying we want to try to restrict these things, could very well have been a statement from the CIA, which runs that stuff, saying, "Oh, really? Well, what about this?" And then they blow up some guy. I'm concerned, as always, that Obama has a hidden constituency that we don't like to think about in this country, which is the national security bureaucracy, the entrenched interests that want to keep things going the way they've been going for a while now. It's going to be a real fight to take that speech and then translate it into something that has teeth in it. By the way, I wanted to say about what your caller said.
Yeah, we have just about 20 seconds.
Okay. He made a comment about why isn't the media covering all these various things. I mean, the reason that caller knows about these things is because the media did report it. I have really no patience for people who say, why aren't the media reporting these secrets when they read them in the New York Times?
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Bob Dreyfus, a contributing editor at The Nation magazine, and Scott Horton, a contributing editor at Harper's magazine. I also just read a House subcommittee just passed a $73 billion military spending bill. So thank you both for joining us, Bob and Scott.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What can we do to bring bees and birds back to our gardens? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about local biodiversity. We recently did a show about disappearing bees, which are needed to pollinate crops. Pollinators keep our ecosystems vibrant and healthy. So what can we do in our backyards and neighborhoods to make sure they thrive? What can we learn from places like Boston, where pollinators are returning? And what are you doing to create pollinator-friendly spaces? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.